Okay. All right. Thank you very much. You can keep going if you like. So I want to thank the organizers for the chance to come here. We've had a lot of great discussions this week. Also, I spent a very lovely afternoon in the trunk of Dave DeMille's rental car the other day. And today what we're talking about is we're going to pose the following question. We're going to talk about ultra-cold molecules composed of alkali atoms of the kind that many people in the room have made or are making. And we just pose the question, suppose those molecules collide, and in the collision there's an extremely high density of resonant states down there. What would be the effect? What would be the effect on ultra-cold collisions? And it is a well-posed question. If I have a density of states that's very high and it's characterized in some way, it is a perfectly well-defined question to ask what the observables are. The real uncertainty here is in that if. Is there a big density of states? But I'm starting from that point. The work was done by these good people here. And let me start with the big picture of cold collisions. I have a couple of molecules here, alkali dimers, and the molecules go in. And by that, I mean they go into some collision event. Something happens down there, which is colored yellow, and then molecules come out the other end. And maybe there's been a chemical reaction, or maybe not. Maybe the states have changed there. And the thing we get, or we hope to get, from cold and ultra-cold collisions is real quantum state-to-state scattering processes. In particular, ultra-cold means you can potentially prepare these in exactly the internal state you want. Maybe you can pick out the partial wave in which these come together, and that's been done, of course, at JOA, and even the component of the partial wave with respect to some external axis. So you have complete quantum state control here. If you make complete quantum state measurements there, you're kind of getting every element of the S matrix. You're getting, if you like, the complete chemistry experiment there. And then your job is to go in and back out what was it that happened in this yellow area that leads from these states to those states. And that is the main job of chemical physics, or maybe physical chemistry. Which is it? Doesn't matter. Okay. And so there are different ways to approach this problem. And there is kind of the good old-fashioned stolid way of chemistry, which works great. You know what you're studying. You build a very accurate potential energy surface to the extent that your electronic structure calculation can do it. You do scattering on it, which can be classical or semi-classical or quantum, whatever you're prepared to do. And it works great. It tells us a lot about chemical physics, like this roaming business that we heard about yesterday, for example. It is not quite so great in the ultra-cold limit. And Jeremy alluded to this in the previous talk. No matter how good your surface is, you cannot predict the scattering length of alkali atoms for sure, and probably not for other things beyond that. On the other hand, there's also been a lot of work about helium molecule collisions in the buffer gas context. That actually works great in this context. But for alkali molecules, one, I don't think we know the surface very well. And two, if we knew the surface, I don't think anybody is exactly prepared to deal with it in full. So we're not going to use that approach. There is also the cold collisions way of looking at things, which is more my background, where you say, you know, things are moving really, really slowly. And so the most important thing are the long-range forces in the entrance channel, the threshold effects, and things, in other words, the easy part that we can do pretty well. And this is where all the control ideas come from. If they're moving so slowly, you can give them a gentle nudge with an electric field and change what's going to happen, change how they affect the incident. So we can deal with the incoming channels in tremendous detail. And then we say, oh, you know, we make some model of the short-range physics, like things fall and disappear. That's the level at which we look at chemical reactions. And by the way, that works great for interpreting the KRB results from JOA. But now you want to do a little better. And so I think on the surface of it, maybe neither of these will quite do what we want to do here in this case. So we pick the third way, the way of desperation, where we say, there is some high density of states there. Let's run with it. This is going to be where the statistical arguments come in. It's what you do when you know nothing. And believe me, brother, I know nothing. And by the way, it is very interesting to me to relate to you now, because we learned from David Nesbitt yesterday that these arguments are not likely to be wrong by more than 12 orders of magnitude. So we're on our way. So here's what I'm going to talk about. I'll lay out some of the ideas and how we do things. Basically, I should say, there's a vast literature on things like this. Chemical physicists have been doing this for years. Nuclear physics people have their own way of looking at it. There's all the quantum chaos stuff. What we're doing here is the first pass through this in the ultra-cold regime, and so we're going to kind of skim through and pick out some of the easy pickings, the simple results, and just see where it gets us. And the examples I'll talk about are these. Many of us know that the KRB molecules, when they're ultra cold, are chemically reactive, and we're used to the fact that, well, they'll just go away by chemical reactions. It was assumed that if you take a different molecule, like rubidium cesium, like Dave has, Dave DeMille, it's not chemically reactive and probably therefore more stable. The semi-classical statistical arguments suggest it may not be so, and that's kind of the main thrust of the talk today. This is a thing we've been thinking about for some time. This is an old calculation we did some time ago, just for fun, just for motivation. And what it is we take two oxygen molecules, O2 molecules. We were so naive in those days. And we did a classical scattering calculation of this form. The molecules are constrained to move on this line. It's a restricted phase space. They can rotate. But that's it. They're just those 3 degrees of freedom. And we do classical trajectory calculations on a realistic-ish surface for that. And a typical trajectory looks something like this. What is this? This is a slice through phase space. Here's the distance between molecules on this axis, the angular momentum of one of the molecules on this axis. And this is a collision that began at large r with a collision energy of a millikelvin or whatever it was. And so only a very narrow range of angular momentum is possible for any of the molecules. They start in zero, in fact. And then as you come together, more phase space opens up, and the blue line is the outline of the allowed phase space there. And this is a classical trajectory. And what happens is you send the molecules in rotationless with 10 millikelvin of energy. They come in and they hit each other, bang. And one of them starts rotating, or both start rotating. And now there's energy swallowed up in the rotation. They can no longer separate from one another. So they go out a certain ways, they come back in, and bam, and they excite a different rotation. And they have to do this many, many times in this picture to finally get to a case where they collide and leave very little rotational angular momentum in both molecules, and then they have enough energy to separate again. And so it's like I have a bottle here with a long, narrow neck, and I insert a hornet into the bottle, you see. And the hornet flies around like crazy, exploring all the phase space in there, trying to get out of the bottle, but it's a very narrow neck bottle. And so he spends a long time in there. And I, as a cold collisions guy, am looking in the narrow neck of this bottle, and I have no idea what's going on in there, but it makes a lot of noise, right? And the question is, how long is the hornet in the bottle before coming out? That's the motivation. And so based on this, just looking at this, I can tell we're exploring a lot of phase space here. In this case, it's not necessarily true that other cases do that, but let's start from that. Let's make this ergodic assumption. Here's another way of looking at it. I apologize, this is blurry. This is more the quantum mechanical view. This is a scattering calculation that Gulvan did some years ago for lithium plus lithium-2. Sort of alkali molecules are involved, but light ones. These are hyperspherical potential curves, and help me out. Is this the lithium-2 ground state plus lithium? Okay, the lowest asymptotic channel is kind of the sort of thing we're thinking about. The molecules come in here. There's a mess of avoided crossings here. And then they just get thrown into bound states of these other potentials. And there are a lot of them. And there's lots of strong coupling back there. And again, this motivates us to think of this picture, that there's some very violent event going on down there. If they're heavier molecules, this would be even worse. If it was molecule-molecule, it would be even worse still. And so this is our justification for throwing up our hands and going, and trying to do some statistical method. We just say, it's such a mess that any level I can think of there probably gets populated. A hypothesis that remains to be tested. So what do you do with that? You go to the chemical physics literature, and they've thought about this for a long time. And you can pose the question, if the hornet is in the bottle, how long does the hornet stay in the bottle before coming out? And the formulation that basically says, well, there's a high density of states back here, the quantum mechanical version of every state you can get into by this multiple scattering process, and that's density of states rho. There is a number of output channels, which is the number of ways to get out of here, and you sort of draw a line in the sand here and say that's a transition state. Any trajectory that gets to there, we assume is going on out, and that has to be modified in ultra cold. But that's the idea. You count up the number of ways to get out. And the rate for getting out of the bottle is inversely proportional to the density of states, because you waste more time in those states, but it's directly proportional to the number of ways to get out. And the thing is, in the ultra cold, we start off in the ground state, and we have to go out in the ground state, the number of exit channels is very small. It's like one. And that's part of the story. So how does that influence what one would see? Well, so there's that fact again. Density of states is related to the mean spacing. And we're just going to take this idea and run with it. So if we have a density of states, what can we do with that? We get a rate. 1/1 rate is a lifetime. That's how long the hornet stays in the bottle. But also, we say, look, if there are going to be resonances in the energy domain, we associate the resonances with the inverse lifetime. And we get a kind of mean resonance width for all the resonances in this high density of states region. And we can go a little further. In the case where, if we just rearrange these formulas, the mean resonance width in this case, relative to the mean level spacing, is from these formulas, it's a number like this. It's the number of open channels divided by 2 pi. So in cold collisions, if there's only one open channel, the mean level spacing is smaller. The mean width is smaller than the mean level spacing. The resonances are resolved there. This is the sort of picture we're building. We expect to see all the resonances. You expect, at least theoretically in a calculation, you would expect to see all the resonances if you had infinite resolution. And moreover, we're in the ultra cold limit, so there are threshold laws. So I take the real energy dependent width of the resonances I expect to see are this mean width modified by some energy dependent function, and that we know from quantum defect theory. So it gives us a scaling, and now there's an energy scaling of the widths. This will become important later on. But the widths, the resonances remain well resolved in this model. Okay, and then what do you do with that? Here's a very schematic picture of scattering. And in like any kind of scattering theory, we divide the world into short-range physics and long-range physics. And the short range is down here inside the bottle where all the density of states are. And the potentials are deep. Wave functions have lots of small de Broglie wavelengths, whatever. That's too hard for us. And then there's a long-range part that has all the threshold behavior, the field dependence, and all the other things. And so what we'll say is, I don't care what's going on in there. I don't know how to calculate that anyway. So I say, let there be a big density of resonant states there. And it has some implication for what the wave function is here at some matching radius, we call it. But think of this as the van der Waals length. It's the transition between short and long range. And then all you have to do is propagate wave functions to long range. That we're very good at. We have all the quantum defect theory techniques for that. So if you give me a density of states there, I can tell you what the observables are. So that's the big if again. So how do we get the density of states? Here's the estimate we do. And I mean, the answer is we're counting on our fingers, because we're trying to do the very simplest thing here. This is a schematic picture for, let's say, an atom and a molecule. And they have some interaction potential, which there's a known C6. We know how deep it is relative to this dissociation threshold. We draw a potential there. There it is. And we say, well, molecules will be incident on this channel. We'll do something back here, and we'll come out on one of these other channels. What are these? Well, there are rotationally excited states of the molecule out here that define new thresholds. And I could easily imagine a collision event that transfers me into one of these, in which case I'm trapped in a bound state of this potential. And I ask, what are all those potentials consistent with conservation of angular momentum? So the molecules initially have zero angular momentum. There's the partial wave rotation about each other, which is S wave or P wave or D wave. That's small. But upon collision, we assume that any energetically allowed mechanical rotation of the molecules is allowed, provided that I take up the angular momentum in the internal angular momentum of the molecules. So this is how we conserve angular momentum. And so we draw a potential there that has the threshold corresponding to the rotational state and has a partial wave, and so a centrifugal barrier corresponding to that. And now we have a potential. Count up the bound states there. And then there's another one. Count up the bound states there. And then there are vibrational states. Here's one. Here's another. Those are the same potential over and over again. Count up the bound states. Add them up. And how many are within a small energy range? That gives you the density of states. And so you get a number from that. And here's the number. If you look at alkali atoms hitting alkali molecules, the density of states are on the order of 1 per millikelvin, which is something, if it's really like that, you might be able to resolve that experimentally. if I run it through the estimates, the RRKM estimates, and get a lifetime, this is lifetimes in the order of sort of 10 millisecond range, 10 microsecond range. So things come together, cling for a while, and then go away. These are still kind of small timescales on these experiments. You may not see that. But if you allow molecules to collide with molecules, they are much more complicated. Four bodies is much more complicated than three bodies. It's not like 30% more complicated. It's more than 30% more complicated. It is, well, here it is. How much more complicated is this? If you look at KRB plus KRB, if you look at rubidium cesium plus rubidium cesium, you gain a millionfold in density of states because there are so many more ways to share angular momentum between these things. And lifetimes jump from microseconds to tens of milliseconds now. And those are experimentally relevant timescales. And so you know, you've given me the if. If leads to this kind of time scale, and now the question is, what would you really see if this were true? What would you see in a gas of molecules? So, before I say that, there is an argument, and it's a good argument, that doing it this way, we're just counting up all possible states, and maybe you don't reach all possible states. Maybe these collisions are not ergodic, or maybe it takes so long to populate all of these states that you never get to them in the lifetime of the experiment. And we don't know that yet. I admit we have yet to do classical trajectories to see this. But here's how the density of states varies as a function of the maximum angular momentum I allow the collision complex to have. That is the maximum sort of the rotation of the molecules or the maximum rotation of the molecules about each other. In the full density of states, we included all the way up to 200 units of that angular momentum. And that's where these 10 milliseconds come from. And you say, that's crazy. No way is it 200 rotational states. I'll give you 100, though. And you know, that doesn't make much difference. I could throw away lots and lots of rotational states in this, cut the phase space way down. It doesn't matter in the energy range we're looking at. Maybe it's a factor of 2 or 3. Yes. Yeah. And therefore, also the angular momentum of the molecules around each other, because they add up to 0. So it's S wave in the lower curve. But you can say, no, that's not, I'm going to give you only 50 rotational states of that form. And okay, that starts to cut into it. There's an order of magnitude. Or maybe you say, look, I'll only give you 10 rotational states. These don't go anywhere. But that's still, lifetimes in the order of 100 microseconds. So it needs to be understood where exactly the real molecules are on this curve. But it's still favoring large lifetimes of the complex. This is kind of a detail, maybe don't even go into it, but if you pick a bunch of random numbers and say that's your spectrum, you might as well have them distributed according to the way quantum chaos would have them distributed. But this is not like we go and measure our levels and they do this. We assert that this is true because we pretend it's chaotic. But for today's talk, it's a small purpose. It's a small point. A bigger point is this. What we do with those levels is construct a short-range K-matrix, which is basically a characterization of the wave function at this matching radius, at the van der Waals radius. And the main thing about it is full of resonances. This mu sums over all the resonances in this density of states we're talking about. There are poles in each one of them. There are coupling strengths. And in the sort of strong coupling limit, the coupling strengths are distributed in some way around the mean coupling strength, the mean width that we had before. So this is all determined within the model that we have. It's the simplest possible model, but there it is. And then you take this and you turn that into observables. And that part is fairly easy. Here's what it looks like. Wait, no, I should have set that up better. And then you can turn it into observables. And here they come. There they are. Oh my gosh, look, what is this? This is the elastic scattering cross-section for rubidium cesium hitting rubidium cesium within this model versus energy. This is a log-log scale. So the energy goes all the way up to a microkelvin here. This is the van der Waals energy of these two molecules. And what you see is it's my God, it's full of resonances. The S-wave resonances are just everywhere. We don't have the resolution in the picture to see them all in there. The D wave have an overall sort of thresholdy background, but it also full of resonances like that. And the main point here is that there's so many resonances, you cannot resolve them even in an ultra-cold experiment. Even if your temperature is a microkelvin, even if it's 10 nanokelvin, your temperature is big compared to the mean spacing. You have no choice but to observe the average over these resonances. And then you get to ask, what is it you're averaging? And it is this. This is where the sticking stuff comes in. So you say, let's say I'm exactly on resonance, and these things scatter right on resonance, then that's resonance means a really long-lived thing. So they fall into the complex. They live there for this 10 millisecond lifetime that we're talking about. But on the other hand, wait a minute, lots of collisions are not on resonance. Remember, the resonances are well resolved here. And so there are plenty of collision energies where nothing happens at all. There's no sticking. They just bounce off of each other. So what we do is we assert that there is a sticking rate constant that goes something like this. We say the sticking rate is a thermal average over velocity. That's the square root of energy. There's a cross section, and we just take the elastic cross section or something like the elastic cross section, which is at unitarity on resonance, 1 over E. But then again, you have to take into account the fraction of collision energies that are actually on resonance, which is something like the width divided by the mean level spacing. And the width has this threshold law built in that we put in before. And if you put all this together, you can count up the factors of E and do thermal averaging, and you find that the sticking rate constant has a threshold behavior itself. It's temperature to the L, where L is the partial wave of the collision. So the sticking is still dominated in the threshold limit by S wave scattering. And moreover, I just put proportionality signs here, but if you kind of carefully work out that average and get the number in front of that, it turns out to be the exact same universal rate constant that you would get if there were no resonances, but at every collision energy there was unit probability to go away. It's the same universal rate constant that Gulvan had, that Paul had, that was used to analyze the KRB experiment. So that means, you know, it's familiar and happy. The average leads you back to familiar things again. So now you can put a number to that rate constant. And if there's a rate constant, there must be rate equations. So now, let us ask, what is the influence of this highly resonant scattering on a gas of rubidium cesium molecules? What happens? Well, here's the density of molecules, and it changes over time. It goes away because of the sticking. Two molecules come together, they stick with this at this rate, they go away. Where do they go? They don't leave the trap, right? They fall into this thing, and they start doing this. They're presumably still optically trapped. But this thing is not a molecule anymore. It's a pair of molecules. It's a collision complex. So let's keep track of that density separately. The density of collision complexes is growing at the same rate, you know, with a half because there's half as many complexes as molecules. That's fine. And then there's a finite lifetime. The complexes will eventually decay. So in the next step, we have the complex will decay with some rate. That's the RRKM rate there that we estimated previously, and then produces two molecules. And if this was the story, there would be an equilibration between these. The molecules would keep falling into the complexes. That would eventually be balanced by the complexes falling apart again. And what would it amount to is that some fraction of your molecules just go dark in the trap. You just wouldn't see them, presumably. It depends on what you do to see molecules. But they're not molecules. They're locked away in these other things. And no harm done, maybe. Okay, but if the lifetime in there, which remember, it's 10 milliseconds, lifetime of the complex is long compared to the collision rate for something else to hit it, then is it a goner or a sitting duck, do you think? It's probably a sitting duck. You're going to clobber it. And there's no way that collision with a third molecule is going to gently bounce off and leave it alone, I think is the point. Something will recombine. It's a six-body problem now. And so they go away. The point is both the molecules and the complexes go away with some rate constant, which is probably also something like a universal rate constant. So you can estimate that. All right. Now we solve these equations, putting numbers in that I've motivated earlier. And here's what you get. So this is rubidium cesium hitting rubidium cesium. What's plotted here is the density of molecules normalized to the initial density as a function of time. And the time runs out to half a second out here. So in this case, the initial density is 10 to the 10 per cubic centimeter. And if you let it go, and if there's no electric field on, then after half a second, you've lost a sort of trivial number of molecules to this effect. It's not that big a deal here. Down here, let's see, in this case, this is the ratio of the number of complexes to the number of molecules or something like that. And so a couple percent of your molecules are hidden away in these complexes in that case. But if you turn on an electric field, that's also a big effect. Okay, thank you. we know that's a big effect. It changes the threshold laws, and that's all been characterized in the Caribbean experiment. It makes things collide faster because you're lowering centrifugal barriers, because you're changing long-range physics in any event. So if you put on 10 kilovolts per centimeter, suddenly in that half second, you've encouraged the formation of molecules more. You're affecting the initial sticking rate, and now you've lost half your molecules in that half second. And correspondingly, the ratio is changes. You get more things locked away in the complexes. And then just for comparison, what if your initial density went up to 10 to the 11 per cubic centimeter? That has a much bigger effect. So now, even without an electric field, this is the rate. Starts off at the initial density, and then whoop, falls down in a half second. You've lost half your molecules already. You turn on a field, and in the first tenth of a second, you've thrown away the majority of your molecules there. That's the kind of influence that would come from that kind of density of states. Just for comparison, just to finish it off, this is a change in topic now, but let's look at the chemically reactive case, the KRB plus KRB. And as David pointed out yesterday, that's exothermic by a whopping 10 wave numbers. And there are, in principle, thousands of rotational states that could be populated there. Again, conserving angular momentum, and a lot of them go into high partial waves. They may be populated, they may be not. We have to see what goes into that. But here's what this statistical theory says about it anyway. This is the chemical reaction rate constant as a function of energy down here in microkelvin. And these are for identical fermions, so that has a threshold law. And in fact, this dashed black line is the universal rate that Paul and Gauvin talk about. It is the rate that fits really well the KRB data. And in the mock-up here, we say, let the KRB molecules come together, find all these resonance states, and then I give them some number of open channels they can decay in. Well, look, the resonance width, remember, was proportional to the number of open channels, which could be a very large number. So you're no longer in the limit where the resonances are well resolved. They are overlapping. And so what you see, for example, if I give it 100 channels to go into, I see this sort of fluctuating structure like this. I see the Erickson fluctuations, is what that's called in the business. These are not individual resonances. This is kind of an overall background. And then if you throw more open channels into it, you say it explores actually 1,000 ways to get out instead of 100, suddenly those broaden so much there's very little structure left overall, maybe a little bit there. That is, in fact, much more like what the experiment sees. To my knowledge, the KRB experiment does not see any structure in that, but it's more or less flat. So from this point of view, anyway, it suggests that maybe lots of channels are available for exiting on. I don't want to make too strong a claim out of that, but qualitatively, the point is there, that in the chemical reactive case, you don't see resonances because nothing lives long enough to resonate. And I think that's about all I'm going to say today. In summary, if we assume a very high density of states, this is the big if, then there are consequences to that. And the consequence is you may see this kind of sticking, and molecules might go away that you did not expect would go away. Or is it? Right? So there are many open questions, but as I said, this is just the first pass through it, and we're already seeing interesting things. So, am I still on time, or do I have to invoke the Dulieu convention? No, okay, so I can make my acknowledgments to these funding agencies, and of course, the most important support I get is from the research group. There it is, and I'll stop with that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, John, for this talk, which was über on time also. I see there are many questions. Olivier.
Yeah, yes, John. Are you okay?
Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
You don't need it anyway. No, okay. No problem. No, I was just wondering, I mean, this picture of the collisions between the two molecules that you are giving, how does it transfer if you look now to a bond state? What would be the picture of a bond state? Assume that you have a non-reactive molecule. What would be the picture of a bond state of rubidium, cesium, rubidium, cesium? What I mean is that you invoke so many resonances, then it would be almost impossible to have an isolated bond state. So you would have some kind of quasi-continuum of bond states, which is something which would be extremely floppy or whatever. And so I was wondering if this kind of ideas, if you went back to those calculations which were made quite a lot in the 90s about the various conformations of the alkali metal clusters. Like, you know, the people were computing, you know, the equilibrium geometry on Na4, potassium 4 or whatever. And they were finding things very floppy as well and so on. And so, yeah, I'm wondering what kind of picture we could have there.
It's a good question, and I'm not quite sure I know what you mean, because, for example, if I
look
really at the ground state of two rubidium, two cesium, for example, you know, all the way down, much lower energies than we're looking here. I kind of expect the density of states to be lower there and things more rigidly locked in. If what you mean is just below this scattering threshold, there's lots of stuff going on and there's floppiness there, I think that's right. And I think I recently became aware of some work by Steve Berry back in about the 1980s talking about even the argon trimer, where if you're low enough in energy, things are kind of rigid and solid-like, and you know, you have shapes of clusters. If you go up closer to dissociation thresholds, it is much floppier, and there's a lot more interesting things going on. Classically, that explores a lot of phase space. And so I don't know what calculations you're referring to, and I don't know if you're up in this energy range.
No, it was definitely lower.
It was much lower, but I think if you go higher, yeah, you would see a lot of zaniness up there, yeah.
And maybe if you allow me just a little bit more thing, because you have shown this lithium-3 hyperspherical representation that Goulven has calculated.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you run such a scattering calculation with these potential curves, does it give already some kind of impression about the fact that there is indeed long-lived resonance or not? Or can we use that picture already because we have it on the quantum picture? Can we already use it to indeed get an insight with this very simple system about some possible long range, you know, I'm sorry, long term resonances or sticking things?
I defer to my younger colleague. I've done that calculation.
So, yes, I think it's possible to. Oh, so we did not do it. We did it as a function of initial vibrational state. So we did not do it as a function of collision energy. But this is something we can do. Yeah.
But I think you did find things like you go to higher vibrational states, and in my language, that increases the number of outgoing channels, and you probably pretty quickly got into the Erikson fluctuation regime.
Well, thanks, John. As you may know, a couple of years back, we did a fully quantum calculation for O2-O2 collisions, and we didn't find that many resonances. I mean, we saw about 100 resonances per Tesla, and I mean, granted, rubidium-cesium is going to be different, but what I was going to suggest is perhaps you could use our calculations to calibrate your theory, because if you could calculate. Yeah, you could calculate your densities of states using your method and compare them with the numbers of resonances we obtain.
Yeah, it's funny you should ask. I am aware of that, but it's oxygen is no longer our thing. But back in the day when we did that, we did a where is it? Is it even in here? You could tell I left out all the good stuff here. Oh man, ask about this. Sorry, I don't have it, I'm sorry. But at the time, we had that surface, we did do, it was not a full calculation, we did what we could. We counted up the density of states. I agree, it was not a huge density of states for O2. It was, that would, yes, absolutely. That's another part of the story. It was rigid rotor, it was, it's O2, it's not a super deep potential. But we did get a density of states out of there. It was, within small number of statistics, it was reasonably consistent with phase space arguments, and we thought we were really onto something. But it was far from definitive. But the other thing I will say is, we also, with the levels we had, which were 20 or 30 levels, we found with the calculations we could do, we calculated this, the Dyson rigidity function. This thing, it was one of the tests for quantum chaos, and it came out leaning toward the sort of chaos side rather than the non-chaos side. If you could go back and redo that with your data, that might be really cool.
So, John, thank you. That was a beautiful talk. Two comments, questions. One is your picture of the of basically this idea where two of the rubidium cesium molecules come together, and then they live for so long that a third one comes in, and that's for sure going to sort of, just completely, that occurs with very high probability. That is basically exactly what happens physically in these supersonic expansions. It's the sort of thing that, that the rate limiting step for forming, really the equilibrium state, which is basically a chunk of argon or whatever, is really the first couple, the dimer formation or trimer or whatever, and then it just completely runs away because these RKM lifetimes become so long that everything accretes to it and it just drops like a rock. Mm-hmm. So I think that idea is exactly right. The second comment is trying to sort of connect to some of our discussions yesterday. When you talk about your O2O2 rigid rotor picture here, and you see this hornet in the bottle. I mean, and I totally buy that. Now, the question that would be maybe relevant to this issue of RKM lifetimes for high frequency vibrations would be if you had, let's say, the O2 vibrate, okay, or one of the O2, and actually, probably you really should make it so that you don't have resonant vibrations because resonances will encourage energy transfer. But let's say you had detuned two diatomics that now you included vibrational excitation as well. And my expectation would be that you would see your rotational chaos, if you will. You'd see that long-lived hornet in the bottle with all sorts of rotational energy transfer, but you may well find that the vibrationally labeled molecule coming in is the same as the vibrationally labeled molecule coming out. And sort of from an RKM picture, it's like that coordinate never became part of the party. And that's really the breakdown of RKM when you have reduced dimensionality due to strong decoupling of one mode from other modes.
So
do you agree with that?
I agree with that. Could I amend my comment to Roman then? Do that. that sounds really interesting.
John, thanks for a really fascinating and beautiful presentation of these wonderful ideas. One of the things that we did in the recent review with Gauvin on ultracold reaction rates and chemical reviews, we put together a tabulation of experimental and theoretical calculations of vibrational quenching, high vibrational levels in the cold microkelvin, 100 microkelvin type domain, where there's some experiments in the literature and also some calculations that have been done. What you find typically is that if you tabulate those rates, they tend to be within a factor of 10 of universality. Very typically, but there's quite a bit of fluctuations from, say, a species level to level, which vibration level, and so forth and so on. Would you say that a factor of 2 to 4 to 5 from universality would come within the scope of Erickson fluctuations, or would that be? Do you have any thoughts about how that might play out?
I'm sorry. What do you mean?
If you have a cold chemical inelastic collision process like vibrational relaxation, and it comes out within a factor of 2 to 4 or 5 of the universal rate constant you would get for the mean through the fluctuations, would the Erickson fluctuations account for up to 2 to 4, 5 factors difference between that? What's the extent of the Erickson fluctuations typically in the microkelvin domain across a variety of species?
I've not looked across a variety of species.
Okay.
I don't know.
You showed, I think, maybe I several showed, factors. Is that right in yours? Because that was a log scale.
Maybe I'll put that back and you tell me what.
There's a body of empirical evidence building that one gets near universality, but within typical factors of 2 or 3 is fairly common difference from it.
Here are the factors in this crude model.
Okay.
And this is not a log scale. So we're a lot closer in this case, above and below, than factors of 2. But I don't know what to make of that. I mean, context of gravitational
quantum. Okay. What a very interesting question for the future for experiments in theory is to understand why these, you know, it looks like it might be near universal, but it's not quite, and so there are obviously differences, which may be breakdown of statistical theory or maybe something within the scope of statistical theory.
Yeah, so. I agree. That's the thing we need to be looking at.
So I was wondering about some sort of limiting cases of your ideas. So for one thing, you've calculated for rubidium and cesium relatively heavy diatomic. For lighter diatomics, I would expect just with high rotational constants, you get significantly shorter complex lifetimes. And also, if you go to polyatomics, you might think it gets exponentially worse. On the other hand, if they're very deeply bound, maybe it's still kind of a rigid rotor approximation, and it maybe doesn't get much worse. I was wondering if you could comment on this.
Well, within this framework, we did estimate density of states for lighter things, things involving lithium, and we ran a whole range of things. And you're right, of course, the lighter things with larger rotational constants have a lower density of states. It's dramatic, but it's not super dramatic. You gain maybe two orders of magnitude in density of state, maybe not even that. Lose,
okay.
Yeah.
And for polyatomics, have you looked at this at all?
I have not.
Okay.
Sorry, I just want to make one more comment. You're assuming ergodicity. And of course, there's been a lot of work in the field where they study collisions of those polyatomic molecules at elevated temperatures, where they actually looked very carefully at how non-ergodic collisions are, and they find that they're very non-ergodic, even for polyatomic molecules, large polyatomic molecules. So you're overestimating the densities of states by a large factor. Because it remains to be found what this factor is.
Yes, that's
the question.
And the
question is how.
Well, ergodicity is a question of where do classical orbits go. And so a very next thing on our agenda is just to do classical mechanics on it and ask, in the sense of the hornet here, how much of phase space do these trajectories really see? And I agree, that is weak link number one in this theory. I might turn around the other. To me, it just seems obvious. Man, these things clobber each other, and there's a big, vast, empty space, and why would they not? But you have to go and see. And from my point of view, I almost want to say, what's the matter with polyatomic molecules that they don't do that? But the fact is they don't, and I'm aware of that.
Francesco.
So first of all, thanks for giving us the way of desperation. And it's promising. So in the lab, we have now rubidium cesium in the ground state. I will maybe just to comment what we can do on the experimental side. So we have sort of enough molecule to start this kind of measurement.
What is your density?
So the density is around 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 11, but we have sort of, an idea to increase a little, but somehow we have an idea of how to improve a little bit the number of molecules before starting. But what we have somehow, it's with cesium-2 molecule, collisional rate of cesium-2 molecule in the ground state, so absolute ground state, control of the final quantum state, and so on. And there we see also very fast decay, which probably...
It's milliseconds, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
It's tens of milliseconds. So somehow, seems that, also speaking with Paul and with Jeremy and you during this conference. So now, during your talk, I tried to do the fit. So if I will able also to introduce the fit. Yes. But the point is that there we are in 2D, two dimension.
Okay.
So
yeah.
maybe there will be some. But yes, we see very short lifetime of ground state cesium-2 molecule.
In 2D, okay. Recalibrated for that, but the ideas are still there.
Can
I buy you coffee?
Okay.
Again, final question by Kunkwan.
I guess it just would be interesting to know what kind of information you can extract from where you have this time dependence of the loss at function of density, initial density. And I was just wondering, maybe a question for Francesca. Is it usually we would say, you can extract a two-body or three-body behavior, you can get a sense of how many bodies are involved, but here is obviously very different. It depends on the density as well. And
it's a very good question. And so, you know, these are really solutions to those rate equations that I put up on the board. And to the extent that it's that, I know how to. I know what those rate equations are telling me. Right? So if you look at the very short time, there's a slope there, and that's completely determined by the two-body sticking collisions. And so the slope there is a direct measurement of the sticking rate. And then it rolls over. In fact, what these arrows are for, you can make a quick estimate of when it stops going down and when it flattens out, because the complexes are coming back. And where that happens depends on the lifetime of the complexes. And so sort of a measurement of the kink there will tell you the lifetime of the complex, which is the biggest unknown, the biggest uncertainty in the calculation. So there is a lot of information in them. And then, you know, then out here, the last little detail is that it will give you, in principle, the rate constant for the molecule hitting the complex. But I think that I can estimate pretty well.
OK, I think we shall close this part of the morning session for now. Thank John again. And reconvene at 11 o'clock.